The 2005 Sunstone Symposium presents session number 236, a panel entitled Frank Windham at 40, Celebration of Levi Peterson's The Backslider, with Sherry Woodworth, Eric Samuelson, Galen Henderson, Morgan B. Adair, Mary Lee Mitchum, and Bruce W. Jorgensen.
Welcome, good morning. This session is entitled Frank Windham at 40, and this is a celebration for Levi Peterson's The Backslider. A novel which was published first in 1986, and so it's coming up for its 20th anniversary. This is one of the original blue cover editions. If you were a collector, you know that this is the one to have. I am coordinating and chairing this session because as the co-editor for book reviews at Sunstone, I realized already last fall that this anniversary was coming up, and I began thinking about my experiences with The Backslider. I first read the book when I was 19 at BYU, and this was right after it came out, probably in 1986. I was recommended to read the book by Tom Rogers, who was my Russian professor, who is an extremely enthusiastic person, and when he is excited about something, he spreads that very liberally. Actually, my husband read the book first, and he said, "Well, don't read it, you won't like it." You'll be shocked. And I was just barely married. So I was 19. I was just barely married. He said, "I think you'll be shocked. Don't read it. Or skip over some of those parts." And he didn't tell me exactly which. He said, "You'll know which ones to skip over." And so I read it. And I tell you the truth, I was not overwhelmed by it. I had some issues with it. I was shocked and appalled to some degree. And then I had a conversation probably within the next year with Gene England when I ran into him at a reception, and I listed my issues with the book, and he patiently listened to me, and he said, "Well, you know, it's still a great book, and I urge you to reread it," and I don't know his words exactly, but this is what I came away with. "I urge you to reread it and think about it, and you know, what you say is all true," but I think he was saying, "You'll get over that, and then you'll begin to see the real value of the book." And he was right, and I have read it many times since then. There's scarcely a passage where I can pick up the book, and within a few lines, I know where I am in the story, and I recognize what's happening. Although, as I read on, I relive it, and I see it in a different way. The title of this session is Frank Windham at 40, not just because the book is almost 20 years old, but also because my perspectives on it has changed from when I was 19, and I'm now 38, and I am nearly 40, and I am rereading Frank with new eyes. I picked up the book and read it on the plane as I was coming out here from Connecticut, and my perspectives on it have changed not just because I have read the book several times now, but also because I have grown up, and my perspectives on life have changed so much. And it has made me much more enthusiastic about the book, and so much so that I want to inaugurate a celebration and a festschrift, that is a celebratory writing project, for the anniversary of the book, which will come up next year. So the purpose of this session is to first get the responses and thoughts of our five panelists who have agreed to participate, and we're very thankful to them, and then to get your thoughts and responses, and to think about what this festschrift project might be, how we might plan it for the coming year, and what we want it to produce. I have my own ideas. I am myself raring to go, but I wanted to get your input as well. We have five panelists, as I said. They're each going to speak about 10 minutes, and they're going to speak in the order they are listed in the program. We're first going to hear from Eric Samuelson, who is a playwright and head of playwriting and screenwriting at BYU, and we're very happy that you came, even though you're at BYU and they may not like that. I understand you stand up for yourself, and no matter what. Then we hear from Galen Henderson, who is a PhD candidate in rhetoric and composition at the University of Utah. And then from Morgan Adair, who is an independent consultant in the software industry. And Mary Lee Mitchum, who is a retired psychiatric registered nurse and an author of a book and recently an essay in Dialogue, if you remember that. I do. And finally, the fifth person we will hear will be Bruce Jorgensen, who is also at BYU and is a known poet and author. They'll each talk for about 10 minutes, and that will take us about to, I can't even think right now, but Then I'll conclude with some remarks, and then we'll like to take comments from the audience. So, beginning with Eric.
Well, I feel a little intimidated here. I haven't prepared really anything, but I thought I would. I thought I'd begin by telling a story. A few years ago, it was just after the film version of Charlie came out. I was going to be teaching an advanced screenwriting seminar, and it was kind of popular, and there were about 15 students who wanted to take it. And as we were talking about the class before it began, I had a meeting with some of the students, and I talked about some things they wanted to be involved with, and many of them were very interested in writing for the emerging LDS film movement. And I said to them, you know, there are a lot of, in Hollywood or in the film industry generally, some of the best films that we know come from prominent novels. Why don't you look at some of the novels that have been written by, some of the outstanding novels written by LDS authors and see if they would be able to, if they would be something. And they all sort of sneered and smirked and said, well, what about Charlie? And I said, well, you know, there's other authors that you ought to look at. Not to knock Jack Whalen, but why don't we? And they said, well, look, Mormon novels are Chris Heimerdinger, they're Jack Whalen. A couple of them knew of Scott Card's work, but I said, you know, there's a lot more than that. And they said, no, there isn't. So I thought, okay, well, we're going to do something about that. So in the class, in the syllabus, I gave them a bibliography of 25 or 30 LDS novels that I thought were really, really good. And I said, you ought to read these. And so we developed an assignment where each of them had to pick one novel off that list, read it, write up a little synopsis of the plot and story and the film potential that it might have, and then also offer their own personal response to it. And then in addition, they were to photo, and then they were also supposed to give a little oral response to it. And so this one girl picked The Backslider, and her written work was, you know, she accurately summarized the plot and so on and talked about how the film, what its film possibilities might be. And then she said, I really hated this novel. It was really bad. She said it was dirty, and it had a bishop who looked kind of dumb, and I just didn't like it. And I thought, well, all right. So I took a second and I said, you know, I mean, you don't have to like it to be in the class. I like it a lot, but okay, you know, so we let it go at that. A couple weeks later, a guy in the class was ready for his presentation. And he said, I'm going to do mine on The Backslider. And I said, well, you know, that's already been picked. Somebody's already done that one. And he said, I know. But he said, I read her plot synopsis, and I thought, I want to read this. And so I read it, and it's the most important book of my life, and I have to talk about it. So I said, okay. So he responded, and he said he's a kid from South Africa. He said, I don't know anything about Southern Utah. I don't know anything about ranching culture. I don't know anything about America. I've only been here a year while I've been a student. But he said, I can't tell you how much I love this novel. And he said, here's the reason why. He said, this novel talks about the worst thing in Mormon culture and the best thing in Mormon theology. And the worst thing in Mormon culture is that we have come to hate ourselves because we have sexual feelings, and we don't like that about ourselves, and it makes us feel bad. He said, when Frank Wyndham took a cheese grater to his knuckles, he said, I've done that because I'm 22 years old, and I have sexual feelings, and I think I'm a bad person because of that. And this novel made me realize maybe I'm not a bad person. Maybe it's okay for me to have sexual feelings. Maybe that's not such a bad thing. But the best thing, he said, is the thing that the girl who'd responded found most offensive, which is the vision of the cowboy Jesus. She had gone on a bit about the inappropriateness of Jesus hand-rolling a cigarette. and she hadn't cared for that. And this South African student of mine said, he said, I just think, he He said, before I became a Mormon, I was Episcopalian. And he said, the pastor would talk about a doctrine I never understood, which is the doctrine of the Incarnation. And I never quite got what that was about, but now I get what it's about. I get what it's about. It's Jesus appearing to somebody in a form they would understand and appreciate. And I suddenly realized Jesus had suffered for my sins. And he says, I always knew that, but this novel made me feel it, and I never really felt it before. Well, at that point in the class, now all of a sudden everybody had to read The Backslider because, you know, there was been this controversy about it, and so the entire class all decided to read it. And some of them didn't like it, and some of them thought it was great. There were a group of about four who were really, really sharp kids, and these four got together, and they formed a little pact, and they said that they would not rest until they'd raised the money to make a film version of The Backslider. I just ran into one of them, kind of Griffin, the other day, and I said, how's that coming? And he said, we've got about $20,000. I said, how much movie can you make for that? And he said, about 30 seconds. So we'll be seeing the first 30 seconds of The Backslider film for sure any day now. And I don't know if anything will ever come of that. I think it would make a glorious movie. I think it would be just a glorious movie. Not the least of which, because you get to aim your camera at Southern Utah, and I don't think you can go very wrong there. Any of you that saw the Book of Mormon movie, I'm sure did as I did, which was forget the plot and the acting and just look at some of the scenery behind them, and it was really made for kind of an enjoyable experience. But I think in some respects, the response my class had to this novel may echo the response of it in LDS culture generally. And number one is that they haven't heard of it. I mean, initially they had never heard of it. They never knew it existed. They didn't know. They'd never heard of Don Marshall or Doug Thayer or Margaret Young or Bela Petko or Levi Peterson or Eugene England or any of the other of the really best people we've got going for us. They'd never heard of Sam Taylor. And so I think if I accomplished anything in that class, I at least got them to read some stuff that they wouldn't have read otherwise, which is, you know, always nice. Then once people do find out about it and read it, then I think that the responses that they have are actually kind of interesting, because I think there are a lot of people in the culture who don't read a lot of fiction, who don't read a lot of literary fiction, and who therefore run into a novel like The Backslider and have much the same reaction to it that the Ayatollah had to the Satanic Verses. But then there are others of us, like my South African student, who actually had no connection whatsoever to anything subject matter-wise, who'd never been to Southern Utah, who didn't know anything about ranching, who didn't, frankly, know all that much about Mormonism. He hadn't been a member all that long, who just grow to love the novel inordinately. And I surely do count myself in that number of people who, for whom this is not just a novel, but just a life-changing book, an important book in our lives, an important thing for us to know about and connect to and appreciate. So that's kind of my thing. I've kept that exercise. Every class I teach now, especially in screenwriting, but also in playwriting, I say you need to read some stuff. If you're going to be an LDS artist, if you're going to be an LDS theater artist or LDS film artist, you need to connect to the very best things that we have going for us in our culture. It won't do to just say, well, Mormon literature isn't worth reading, there isn't anything that's any good. That's not so. It isn't true. And plug into your culture. One thing I'm trying to think of, if I can get away with at BYU, would be require all my students to purchase a year subscription to either Sunstone or Dialogue. I don't know if I'm quite able to do that yet, but...
Both.
What?
Both.
Yeah, I'd love that, too. I can just say, I'm not going to require a textbook in this class. Instead, you need to plug into what's going on in Mormon culture. You need to be aware of the debate. You need to take part in the conversation. And unless you're informed, unless you're part of that conversation, you are diminished as an artist in this culture. We'll see if that ever is able to happen. But in the meantime, I can just say that it's a great, great privilege for me to be here and honor this great book. Thank you.
Dan Witherspoon was talking to me about being on this panel, and he suggested, well, just give a personal your personal response to the book. And I was talking about that with Bruce Jorgensen, and I said, I'd like to do something from a woman's perspective, a female perspective. And he said, well, do you identify with Marianne? And that got me thinking, and so I have prepared something that I hope you don't mind if I read it. Marianne, of course, is the young girl who plaintively cries out to Frank, I know you love me. What we've been doing with each other, that's because we're in love. The very frankness of his reply is devastating. I just wanted to have you, just because you're a woman and I'm a man. It's the worst thing I ever did in my life. I ain't got no excuse. I've been sweet-talking you just so you'd let me do it. Yes, I relate. Like many women, I have perhaps given greater weight to the words I love you than a male perpetrator intended. But what I won't claim is that this painful scenario represents the lot of all women, nor that all men are frank. One significant difference between Marianne and me is the fact that she is not, after all, born Mormon. Perhaps, therefore, she is less constructed by religious ideology, perhaps more a creature of her physical body than either her peers in rural Utah or her contemporary LDS readers. And certainly I can only aspire to be as spiritually redemptive as is Marianne. She claims a glorious role in the story because hers is the initial comforting vision of the cowboy Jesus. But even more importantly, I believe, she embodies the comfort of sexual love and acceptance. Simone de Beauvoir, a feminist pioneer, claims, one is not born, but rather becomes a woman. What I want to suggest is that Marianne's growth from deceived girl to redemptive woman reveals to me a vision of becoming. Where I begin when I ponder female identification in the backslider is seeing myself uncomfortably in Frank's mother, Margaret. From everything to her pitiful pleas, I have six sons, to her son that he conform to proper church standards. Have you been breaking the word of wisdom? Do you smoke and drink? To her being duped by his reassuring lies. Oh, I am so relieved to hear it. To her nutritional notions about Coca-Cola. That's pure poison. Like Margaret, I have tried to solve all my family's emotional and physical problems with annoying admonitions to avoid processed sugar and meat. While reviewing the backslider last week, I looked ruefully into my refrigerator full of soy milk, tofu, sprouted wheat tortillas, and 15 kinds of vegetables. But in spite of my green diet, I don't want to end up Margaret. The valuable work that the backslider accomplishes for Mormon readers is its uncompromising honesty about our absurdities. Absurdities, rather than ensuring health, pose dangers, emotional, spiritual, and physical. I remember a delightful talk that Elder Paul Dunn gave to the Highland Utah Stake, admonishing us to avoid extremism of various kinds. The rumor was, of course, that Elder Dunn could be regularly seen at the local Smith's with a cartload full of Coke. Mormon culture needs lots of storytelling about the consequences of extremism, be it from Paul Dunn or Levi Peterson. The novel's rich, thick text is laden not with satiric commentary, but with faithful reporting of anomalies. Hearing the pin drop in the tabernacle is another witness as to the truthfulness of the Book of Mormon. And the BYU religion professor's research into the grammar of the true Adamic language. All we have to do is carefully work out the predication and subordination patterns in all four books of Scripture. We'll be getting close to the way God thinks and talks. Extremity, absurdity, funny stuff. Except such tendencies can turn dark, as demonstrated by Frank's journey toward blood atonement for his sins. Joseph Smith, attempting to persuade Nancy Rigdon to plurally marry him, wrote, "Happiness is the object and design of our existence. That which is wrong under one circumstance may be, and often is, right under another. Our Heavenly Father is more liberal in his views and boundless in his mercies and blessings than we are ready to believe or receive." Why don't we believe this? Must we as a culture atone for the excesses of polygamy with a pervasive guilt that quashes the very sexual life out of ourselves? In my view, the most important cultural critique that the backslider in the body of Levi Peterson's work offers is its inquiry into what is repressive and dangerous about Mormon attitudes towards sex. Characters like Frank lie to their mothers and sometimes to their girlfriends and other wives about their sexual behaviors, and they yearn for a place to hide against the all-seeing eye of God that will remain unflinchingly honest in their own self-assessment as guilty sinners and the resultant self-condemnation. If we dismiss the idea that Jeremy is typically Mormon in his self-castration, in his rejection of the body with its proclivities for sexual desire, masturbation, killing, and eating of animals, then perhaps we will see Mormonism elsewhere, perhaps in the cognitive dissonance incurred by expectations of outwardly demonstrated worthiness. In the church, our decisions about obedience and even testimony don't remain private. For Frank, for us, we always bear the ever-present, for Frank, for us, merely to partake of the sacrament with unrepentant sin means damnation to the soul. Yet we always bear the ever-present awareness that friends and neighbors may notice if we pass along the tray. Maybe the pressure of outward compliance versus the demands of our internal conscience is a perfect breeding ground for crazed impulses and self-punishment. So the Mormon female reader of The Backslider, at least one, identifies not only with female characters, but she also sees herself as Frank, as Jeremy, as sexually driven and ideologically constrained, in other words, as Mormon. As Toral Moy puts it, our subjectivity is always embodied, but our bodies do not only bear the mark of sex. Race, class, social environment, including religion, mark our lived experience. And sexual repression, as well as any repression, makes for unhealthy outcomes. Clarissa Pinkola Estes, in Women Who Run with the Wolves, offers the example of the woman who suddenly runs away from home. When a woman pretends to press her life down into a nice, tidy little package, all she accomplishes is spring-loading all her vital energy down into shadow. Fine, I'm fine, such a woman says. We look at her across the room or in the mirror. We know she's not fine. Then one day, we hear she has taken up with a piccolo player and has run off to Tippecanoe to be a pool hall queen. And we wonder what happened, because we know she hates piccolo players and always wanted to live on Orcas Island, not on Tippecanoe, and she never mentioned before anything about pool halls. Notes from my diary from last week. Sometimes I feel I'm heading for a nervous breakdown, if there is such a thing. Bruce Jorgensen told me that the backslider scene about castration is one of the reasons that Richard Craycroft says the book is not Mormon. But I've always felt that Mormons have the capacity for sudden strange actions, because the buildup of pressure finally blows the lid off. Maybe I can express this cognitive dissonance in my backslider talk. No wonder Jeremy did what he did. People sometimes go crazy. But not always. The reason I love this novel is because it offers an alternative to cultural insanity. Marianne's simple, ordinary acceptance. Acceptance of the body, of her husband, of sexuality. She shows how sexual love may be a great blessing, even when initiated outside of marriage. A joy as enriching as Joseph Smith described. I loved you so much. This is what Marianne said to Frank. I loved you so much. I did love you so much. Further, Marianne exemplifies generosity and faith. One is not born, but becomes a woman. Marianne pictures the cowboy Jesus. She pleads with him, "Sweet Jesus, help us before it's too late." And Jesus shows that it is not too late. Cowboy Jesus saves Frank because Marianne proffers the paradigm, but more importantly, she materializes that image with her unfailing physical love. Without such sexual affirmation, Frank would likely also have gone off the deep end. By comforting his body, she saved his soul, and he constructs a rescuing vision. Marianne teaches a woman reader that she is the answer to the secret that men are always trying to penetrate, that she is love, endless, infinite, overflowing, boundless, connected, that she is a spring of water, that she will never dry up because she is part of eternal growth, and that not just women, but men and all creation are the same, not doomed creatures tortured by physical needs and losses, but embodied possibility, love. Marianne sees that all things are possible in Cowboy Jesus. Woman knows, I know, as Marianne predicts, something good will happen to us. Something will change. It has to.
Although I grew up in Minneapolis, which is relatively cultured and refined compared to the southern Utah setting of The Backslider, the characters and setting of the book are very familiar to me. My parents are both natives of the southern Utah town of Tropic near Bryce Canyon. Every two or three years, we loaded up the station wagon for the long, hot trip across the plains to a family reunion. Relatives gathered from Orderville, Panguitch, and Cedar City. My uncle Lamar Lefevre, his real name, was there. There was also my cousin Vic, who reminded me a lot of Frank Wyndham, although I'm sure Vic didn't think about God as much as Frank did. When he was 10, Vic chased me around the house with a steak knife. By the time he was 20, Vic was a genuine cowboy who would occasionally show up drunk at a funeral lunch or another family gathering. There's another character in The Backslider who is also quite familiar to me. It's not the cowboy Jesus. This character doesn't actually appear in the book so much as preside over it. Frank Wyndham called him the bastard in the sky. People have told me they don't find Frank Wyndham's concept of God in Mormonism, but I remember him quite clearly. Some people, Seinfeld fans, have called him the soup Nazi God, who looks for any excuse to send us away empty-handed. Others refer to him as the accountant God, the double-entry bookkeeper who keeps the debits and credits that weigh the balance of our lives. But more accurately, he's the celestial CEO who manages the accounting firm. The books are actually kept by the angels above us, who are silent notes taking. The holy angels who are watching over us night and day, and they keep a faithful record of the good and bad you say. Frank Wyndham kept his own set of books. Reading from The Backslider, opening the notebook, he added two marks to a long row, wetting the pencil tip in his mouth. He carefully totaled the row, 46 marks. 46 times he had had sex with Mary Ann since their wedding day. It frightened him to see how the marks were accumulating because he didn't know how to undo them. They were lining up like pickets in the fences of hell. It was time to add up the good deeds he had performed during the past week, time to see what credits he might have accrued. He had said his secret prayer both night and morning. He had read from the scriptures every evening except Friday. He had been kind to Marianne, hadn't said sharp words to her. On Sunday, he had attended priesthood meeting, Sunday school, and sacrament meeting. I'd like to say that The Backslider helped me to see the light and come to a new appreciation of God's love and grace, but it didn't quite happen that way. Or maybe it did. I can't say for sure if the book helped open my mind to those ideas and feelings, or if it just resonated with what I was already experiencing. For me, receiving grace was more a process than a cowboy Jesus-like epiphany.
Whoever said that you don't find Peterson's concept of God in Mormonism is just wrong. You do in Levi Peterson himself. And if we as members of the church are relevant to Mormonism, then as Christian Mormon artists of one sort or another, fiction or writers of nonfiction, what we say, especially when we're writing about religious issues, is relevant to Mormonism. So at least that's my concept of art. My first contact with Levi S. Peterson was 23 years ago in a big used bookstore in Manhattan. I had just moved to Brooklyn with my family. And I just stumbled across a copy of Canyons of Grace. I was completely intrigued with it. I looked at it, and I was a Catholic. And the initial story was the Confessions of St. Augustine, which certainly sounded very Catholic to me. And then I turned it over, and I saw an endorsement by Paul Horgan, who has always been one of my favorite Catholic writers. Things as They Are, I think it's just a beautiful book that he wrote. And I was a Catholic, but I also knew that on my mother's side of the family, everyone was Mormon. Her people and their people and their people and their people, all Mormons. So it just seemed like perfect for me to read. I read it, and I was very taken with it. And I wrote the author and said, you know, I come from this tradition that has wonderful reading, just, you know, a lifetime of wonderful reading. What should I read in your tradition? I'm really excited. And I got back this really short list of things, you know. But Sunstone was one of them. So, but even before I became a Mormon, I subscribed to Sunstone. And have always been very grateful to have done so. And then in due time, I got this from Levi. It's nicely signed, and there's a nice old picture of him and his lovely family in it. And so I wrote a review of both books for a Catholic magazine that's sort of similar. It's called St. Anthony Messenger Magazine. It's sort of similar to Ensign, I would say. It's for families. And they also have a press, and they published a book that I had written about my life, a small book, nonfiction, called An Accidental Monk. But I thought I'd read that review just so you can see how a woman so many years ago, a Catholic woman, responded to him. It says that I'm presently working as a part-time registered nurse in an acute psychiatric unit in Coney Island Hospital, and that I don't know about you, but I'm always on the outlook for new novelists. I especially keep my eyes open for someone with something significant to say about God or about those who yearn after him. I want writers practiced in both disciplines, faith and fiction. So it is with pleasure that I introduce a Latter-day Saint writer, Levi S. Peterson, to the mostly Catholic audience of St. Anthony Messenger. I have been reading his work since 1982, when I happened upon his book of short stories, The Canyons of Grace, in a secondhand New York bookstore. What sort of Mormon work was that? The front cover speaks of grace. The back cover carries an endorsement by Paul Horgan, the historian and novelist of the Southwest. And the initial story is entitled The Confessions of St. Augustine. Heck, I was so intrigued I would have paid full price for it. As it turned out, the stories made rewarding reading. One of them, The Christianizing of Coburn Heights, is a hilarious tale of a well-heeled Salt Lake City stake, Reed Parish, that decides to employ gospel principles to rehabilitate, redo, and give a new personality to an elderly lady who is more interested in being a Sunday school teacher than in improving herself. It's a tricky subject, the bag lady type, but our storyteller pulls it off. And if there was ever a unique ending, Peterson had the nerve to use it first. And I would say that character was an artistically transforming character to me. It seems to me Peterson is a writer who searches the high ground in a way that is both agonizingly sincere and crude as clay. And I was shocked at the crude as clay part, but in a good way. That was also artistically transforming to me. He has little tolerance for the niceties or hypocrisy, but he doesn't just run religion through the same old ringer. His characters live and breathe the struggle for faith. As an unpublished Catholic novelist myself, I can assure you that it's a lot harder to illuminate mysteries of affirmation than conventions of disbelief. I admire anyone who tries. In my opinion, it's a work of prayer. The Backslider is Peterson's first novel, published last year by a local house in Utah, since he says in a letter it apparently has no appeal whatsoever to the general American reader, as I judge, because 3 New York publishers and 2 agents turned down the manuscript. Don't let that deter you. Order the novel by mail. The man is a professor of English at Weber State College in Ogden, Utah. His subjects and verbs do a lot more than just agree. The novel is flawed in places, as most first novels are, but the book is worth the price for chapters 7 through 10 alone. His title gives an idea of what the novel is about. Frank Winham, a young modern-day Mormon ranch hand, is deeply religious. He has a tendency to lie and avoid his mother. Since what he genuinely believes and what he does not since what he genuinely believes and what he does are not exactly congruent, he stays well tormented, expecting the worst. As he nears his breaking point, the tension mounts in this dead serious slash comic novel until the reader who has been enjoying the ride begins to feel tormented too. Only a large dose of mercy will save the day. Although Frank Windham's God could have taken the easy way out by simply creating Adam and Eve, when he stopped to consider how his creatures were going to behave, he decided they deserve to have apes and monkeys for ancestors. In Peterson, we have a writer who's stubbornly true to his roots, both Mormon and animal. He deserves considerable respect and readership for this work, which is not yet being sold on open shelves in the official Mormon church bookstore. I don't know if any Catholics ordered it, but I think that it's a book that our program talked about it as a transformative work, and I think it's transformative on a lot of levels. It is artistically transformative. The whole story of Frank is basically the story of psychological transformation. And I just wrote a little note. I think actually where Frank ends up, I would say that he's had a born-again experience at the end of the book, and I know you're not supposed to find that in Mormonism either, but in just trying to understand what a real born-again experience is, I think that he, well, this is a little paragraph I have written in the book, a very good book about what it takes to start on the Christian path for real. It takes a broken heart and contrite spirit and a connection to the divine or the way or to the other, whatever we choose to call the numinosity that most draws and affects us. I call it God. And I think that he's ready now to practice his Christianity at the end of the book. I think the character of Jesus on the horse is absolutely brilliant. And with the cigarette, I think the cigarette in some ways is the most brilliant part of it. And I'm not big on, I'm not triggered by word of wisdom things, but I am triggered by cigarettes because my mother could never stop smoking, and I saw, you know, cancer coming like a train with her on the tracks, and then it hit her and killed her. So it's hard for me to, it's not something I think it's funny or anything. But I got it. He totally made me understand the way he was using that. And he pulled it off. Because had he not pulled it off, I would have been turned off, and I wasn't. I loved it. I think that's what I want to say. I think it's definitely a daring book, and I wish he'd try a sequel and tell us what's happening to Frank now. Thank you.
I've been trying to make up my mind if I should confess that The Backslider got me in trouble in 1986. I guess I'll tell, since we've done a little anecdotage here, I'll tell that anecdote. I was the awards chairman for the Association for Mormon Letters back then, and my practice was to find someone who would serve as a judge in each category, and I did that. I put the bite on one of my colleagues and said, I want you to judge the novels this year. Kind of unbeknownst to me, what she did was create a committee, and I never knew who the members of the committee were except for possibly one other person. Anyway, I read the citation that she and her committee had composed. I, to this day, don't know whose words were which in that citation. And And afterward, someone from Signature Books asked if they could, before reading the citations in the awards ceremony, I had explained that how I had handled the judging and left it up to the judges, and I said I wrote none of these citations, though I have exercised small editorial liberties on some of them. Well, afterward, someone from Signature Books asked me if they could use the citation for The Backslider in an ad for the novel. And I said, yeah, sure, yeah. And I think I reminded him that I was not the author of the citation. Anyway, when the ad appeared in the Salt Lake Papers, or maybe just the Trib, someone can do the scholarship on this. You'll have to trust my memory at the moment. There was the quotation, a brief quotation from that, and it was attributed to me. And part of what the quotation said was that this book was a hell of a good read, which is true, which I hardly agreed with. But a couple of days later, I got a call from the very highest levels of BYU administration asking about this. I had, in the meantime, already called Signature Books and said, you know, I told you, I said, that those were not my words, and I don't like being, well, you know, I think it was, to me, anonymous. I said, I don't know who wrote those words, but they were not mine. And they apologized to me, and I said, I appreciate that, and, you know, you don't have to do a retraction or anything, but anyway, so that's it was brief trouble. It was less than a tempest in a teacup or teaspoon, but that maybe is illustrative of something or other, isn't it? Well, the main thing I want to say here is that Backslider, as we've already been reminded, is fun, or at least the readers who like it think so, and there is this differential response, and it's not just dichotomous, it's probably trichotomous or hexachotomous or something, I don't know. And even readers who have complicated reactions to the novel, as does my old friend and intellectual fencing opponent, Dick Craycroft, I think even some of those readers will admit that it is fun. Well, as did Samuel Johnson and maybe Virginia Woolf, I rejoice to concur with the common reader. I began life, my reading life, as a common reader, and I think I remain one, though now I'm some sort of professional reader who has to try to explain to himself and his friends and students what's going on when he's having his fun reading. But that need not and does not always spoil the fun. Backslider is fun because it's meant to be. It's made to be fun, if a reader is willing to join in, and that's a huge if, I know. The first paragraph is fun. That's why you go on. At 3:30, what's the most cliche way to open a story known to mankind? Tell me, Mary Lee.
What's that?
Well, there's that. Yeah, no, I wasn't thinking Bulwer Lytton. I took a risk here. It's having a character wake up, you know. The first rays of the morning sun penetrated the, oh, you know. Creative writing teachers get so bored with that. Well, here's a somebody wakes up opening. There are a lot of good ones, and there are good reasons why people writing stories do this. At 3:30 on a May morning, Frank Wyndham, guy. Well, you know, you do. You hear, some readers are going to, part of the fun in that very first line is hearing an echo of something like an old ballad, an old, you know, I don't know. Frank Wyndham got out of his bunk and said his prayer. His prayer, not his prayers, but his prayer. He reminded God of their bargain, which was that if God would give him Rhoda, he would live up to every jot and tittle of the commandments. Well, if you're not having fun by the end of that sentence, I'm sorry, your heart ain't in the right place. You're not reading. Actually, it was Frank's bargain. And it's endearing in Frank, as this narrator presents him, that Frank is aware it's his bargain, God never having confirmed it. that was the way with God. And now we're fully into the mode of free and direct discourse. Sorry for the jargon. That's part of being a professional reader. But our narrator here is close to Frank, is friendly with him, is identifying with Frank's consciousness. These could be Frank's words. That was the way with God. He never offered Frank any signs. He never gave him any encouragement. He left him penned up with his own perversity like a man caught in a corral with a hostile bull. Okay, well, that's fun. And that's why, I mean, readers who like it, they're liking it because they're having complicated and very nourishing and encouraging and transformative fun. A lot of the sentences in Backslider is fun. I read almost exactly two-thirds of it last week, trying to get ready to say something here about it. Right to chapter 7. Okay? Into chapter 7. Lucky me, the best is yet to come. And I've been there. The characters in this book are fun. The minor ones, even in their names. Like, well, Randella Cranpitz is only peripherally alluded to in this novel. But even in their names, the minor characters, Dr. Washley at the State Hospital, names which Smollett or Fielding or Dickens might have made up, or even Henry James on an amused afternoon, you know. Any of those characters might have walked out of Chaucer or out of Shakespeare, at least out of his gallery of clowns and secondary characters, and right through southern Utah, maybe Tropic, maybe Salina, though my hometown of Salina is a very sober town and we're very normal in Salina. I got to promise you, I knew no one in Salina like these folks. Starting with me, and right through, right out of Chaucer or Shakespeare, and through southern Utah, and into the pages of this book, I guess I'm going to indulge myself from page 2 and read you Clara. Clara, this is Clara Earle. Clara had the shape of a tripod, fat thighs, big buttocks, narrow shoulders, a little head. She had tartar teeth, ruddy cheeks, and cheerful eyes. And this morning, she wore a blue kerchief over her uncombed hair. She's serving breakfast at the ranch. She was the sweetest, most motherly person on earth. And Frank wouldn't have traded her for 6 of Wesley. Well, neither would I. Although I wouldn't trade Wesley for 6 of a whole lot of people. The plotting in the Backslider. Tell me when I've outrun my time, please. I cannot look at clocks when I'm getting enthused about fiction. Levi's plotting in the Backslider, which I've always envied, and I have a wonderful letter from Levi to me about that, when I said, gee, I wish I could learn to do that, you know. It's grand comic fun, moment to moment. Right down inside of scenes, it's fun. It's kind of quiet. It's not as belly laugh stuff as some of the sentences and some things in the scenes. And there's not time for me to try to track through, say, chapter 1, where this struck me as I was rereading. I thought, man, this guy knows how to do comic plotting. The action. Plot is the representation of the action, Aristotle says. The action of the Backslider, though it includes at least one tragic deed, Jeremy Wyndham's self-mutilation, is fundamentally comic. The action here is how Frank Wyndham finally gets married, or begins to be fully married, to Mary Ann Earle. And at the end of the novel, by the way, Frank Wyndham in 1956, the year this novel begins, in summer of 56, the famous airliner crash in Grand Canyon, June 30th, 1956, the upcoming second Eisenhower election is over. Frank is 20, so he'd be 69 years old now, and I bet he's still going strong with Mary Ann. Good for them. The ending of this novel, talk about affirmation. She squeezed lotion onto her hands and began to rub. Do you want to tell me what was the good thing that happened to us? The good thing she said was going to... That's the comic spirit, by the way. Something good is going to happen. It's going to befall. We can't all on our own make it. We need grace, or we need the good fortune that's built into the way the world works, which is another name for grace, I take it. Just a complicated one, and secular sounding, all right. If I can, he said, I had a vision. A vision? I don't believe I can say any more about it right now. We know all about it. Jesus is kind, just like you always said. Oh, Lord, Frank. He had unzipped his pants, but he couldn't take them off because she was hugging him tightly. We don't need to cry. He said, I don't know about you, but this ending in its sort of low comic mode is as exultantly comic as the ending of Mozart's Magic Flute, which for me is the great transcendent comic moment in all the literature or art that I know. We don't need to cry, he said. So happy that you are crying. It doesn't matter. I'm all right. I'm just all right. Can I smell that perfume up close? Sure, you bet, she said, unbuttoning her gown. Sure, you bet. Everything that's been said here so far is summed up in a scene like, am I running out? I did want to do one more thing, but I'll quit. Okay. Having put the cart before the horse, I want to back up. But that ending, by the way, Levi disavows any influence from Joyce's Ulysses, which he confesses he did read. But if you want, you know, and yes, I said, yes, I will, yes. Molly Bloom. But Molly is inside her own head at the end of that novel, remembering a yes. This is dramatic scene. This is Marianne saying yes to Frank. And Frank, of course, saying yes to Marianne at long last. Can I smell that perfume up close? My breasts all perfume, Molly Bloom says at the end, remembers at the end of Ulysses. So, okay, now again, that's the kind of thing us professional readers will do, and forgive us, please. Back to page 231, chapter 7, Frank's proposal to Marianne. Is this or is this not a brilliant comic scene? By the way, this novel is convincing me that all weddings are shotgun weddings. One way or another, someone feels like, damn, I gotta do this. You know, do it or die. So, take that. Okay, so here they are. He was alone in the room. This is the parlor at the ranch house. A gold-faced German clock ticked on the piano. From the radio came a calm, quiet voice advertising suits at Auerbach's in Salt Lake. A Belgian rug with a thick woolly nap lay in the middle of the room. Over the fireplace hung the head of a trophy desert ram. Under it was a 12-gauge shotgun. Marianne stood in the doorway, her bare feet peeking from beneath her pink flannel nightgown. She said, I didn't want you to come here. I've got to say one more thing. It isn't decent for that little kid not to have a name. It can have my name, she said. It's been okay for me. I can't just walk off on that little kid. You aren't going to get to, she said. Dad's planning on having a little talk with you about child support. He's already mentioned it, Frank said. You bet. I sure will make payments. All right, now go home. She leaned against the door jamb. Please, Frank, leave me alone. You hate me, he said. You wouldn't want to marry me. That's right. I hate you a lot. You don't want to marry me either. You never did want to. That's true. I never did. Well, then, that about takes care of things, doesn't it? What if we got married for about a year, he said. We'd live together like a brother and sister. We'd treat each other like Christians, like God wants us to do. Then when the baby has been here for a while and things are all settled down and people aren't paying much attention, we'll just get us a divorce. Maybe once in a while you'd let me come and see the little critter so to know it had a daddy somewhere in the world. Marianne crossed the room and sat on the sofa, curling her feet under herself and adjusting her nightgown. She shook her head. That is about the dumbest idea I ever heard in my life. I rest my case.
Well, thank our five panelists. When I asked Dan if we could do this session, I said, I don't need to say anything. Just find me some people, or let's get together some people who have something to say about the backslider. And I really appreciate your comments. But having listened to what you said, I find I do not just want to say something, but I have to say something. I just wanted to add some of my own responses, especially hearing Bruce talk about the way he has responded to it. I'm going to say that as I flew out from Connecticut a week ago, and I was flying with two babies on an airplane, so I didn't plan to have a lot of time to read, but I took with me the backslider because I thought, well, I'll pick it up and look over it. Maybe I can refresh my memory before I go into this session. And it was exactly like that. I started to just find my favorite lines in there. I'd pick it up and I'd say, I'll just find some favorite lines that I can refer to. And every place I'd pick it up, I would find something, so much so that I started to turn down the pages of the book. And my husband would think that's a desecration. I'm not allowed to do that. But I didn't have a pencil, so I couldn't keep track of all these lines I was finding. That I said, oh, yeah, I want to use that, or I want to remember that. I was afraid as I was sitting on the plane all squashed in there with a full flight that somebody was going to look at me and say, what are you laughing at? I said, well, you know, I'll tell you what I'm laughing at. You've never heard of this book, but this is what I'm laughing at. For example, Frank is up at the University of Utah and stumbles into a frat party. This is page 20. This is early on. And he stumbles onto this woman, young woman named Inez, and she put her arms around him and snuggled her cheek against his chest with her body slightly askew, so when he bent his head, he was staring into her cleavage. My name is Inez, she said. What's yours? He had never before in his entire life been hit in the nose by a fact that a man could tell when a woman was ready to fornicate. He was thinking about the estrus mare, about how she had backed up to that gelding, whinnying and snorting and wiggling with excitement, and about how this beautiful, busty Inez had just backed up to him, so to speak, except, of course, Frank was no gelding. He was wondering why nobody ever told him a university was like this. That's what I was laughing at. I've spent most of the last 20 years in university in one way or another. And I say, Frank's experience is certainly eye-opening. There were many times when I was laughing, and as has been brought up by our other presenters, this is a funny novel. Actually, the first time I was reading it, I didn't get it because I was apprehensive about the dark side of this novel, the overhanging threat that seems to come through. And my interesting reaction is the more I read it, the more times I read it, the funnier it gets. And as I will remark in a little bit, the dark side of it also gets stronger. The thing about my reaction to this novel is not that it's not only that it's a personal read, but that it has created a community of readers for me. I don't know if you've had this experience, but we've moved around a considerable lot, and we keep in touch with the Mormon community, sometimes more, sometimes less. And then when people come in and out of a university ward, and we're kind of skittish about people, and so when we think that somebody might be, you know, our kind of people, we ask them if they've read The Backslider, right? And this is the first test. If they've read it, then they, first, A, have they read it? Do they know what it is? And B, what's their response to it? And if you find somebody who has read it, you know at least that they're in the same camp, that they would give it a try. And then you find out what they thought about it. And people that you don't know, they've just moved across the country, and you can find they have this instant identification. Their response may be somewhat different, but at least you know you share something. It's better than getting up and giving your testimony of the Book of Mormon, because everyone's always the same on that, and it's not that thought-provoking. And then there's the other litmus test is when you meet somebody new who hasn't read it, or an old friend who hasn't read it, and you get to the point and say, I wonder if you'd be willing to read this book and give it a try. And then you find out who's willing to read it all the way through. I've handed this book on to a couple of people, and they've read it through, and they didn't have anything particular to think about it or say about it, but at least they got through it. And I have had a particular anxiety handing it on to people who are non-Mormon. It's very interesting, Mary Lee's comments about this. I just last year sent it on to a friend of mine who had, I figured he was safe because he had studied Mormon history some with Richard Bushman at Columbia, although he's non-Mormon. And I sent it on to him, and I said, well, maybe you'd be interested in reading this. And he wrote back months later when he got around to reading it, and he said, this is a great novel. And I was really pleased that this over, not just within the Mormon community, but more broadly. I think Levi Peterson had a bit of bad luck and should not have taken it as the final word that the publishers in New York decided not to publish this novel, because I think it does have a broader readership. I am very pleased to hear that there are some committed fans of the novel who are planning to make a movie out of it. I hope they come through with it. I have thought many times what the movie would be like. I've thought through actors and think, who would be Frank Wyndham? The problem is you've got to get somebody who's both young and very thoughtful, but in a cowboy sort of way. And who are you going to get who can do that? I want it to be a movie because the visuals in it would be so fabulous, as Eric mentioned, just the scenery of southern Utah. But I also, in the most recent reading, thought this would make a great movie because the dialogue in it is so right. And I was struck by that because I had just been out to my grandma's funeral a couple of weeks ago. My grandma died at the age of 90. She grew up in Overton, Nevada, which is further south in the canyon country, down in the desert, closer to Las Vegas. When I was reading through this and the words are coming out, maybe I'm more sensitized to it now that I've been living in the East and I've been living in other places. You get away from it, and then you can really feel it. This is the way my grandma talked. She said, he don't do this, and she was educated enough to know better, but this is the way she talked, and this is the way my dad talks a lot of the time when he's got his guard down. And I can hear that this is real, genuine speech. This is real people talking. And then I was reading along, and I got to another one of my favorite lines that made me laugh. And it goes like this. Nathan, that old ranch hand, and Frank are out stacking hay. Nathan doesn't do anything because he's too old. He just stands around. Frank's doing all the work. And the problem was that Nathan's going to talk to him while he's a captive audience. So he says, Nathan stretched and spit and got himself a drink of water, and he began to talk. He had three topics, and that is a funny line if you've ever been with someone who talks too much and always on the same thing. That, to me, just made me laugh again and made me wonder who was going to be looking over my shoulder saying, what are you laughing at? And then the interesting thing was I was thinking about my grandmother's funeral, and I gave the eulogy at the funeral, which was a new thing for me. I didn't never given a eulogy, never even been to a funeral where I heard a eulogy because I don't go to funerals very often. Anyway, I was reading along on one of Nathan's three topics. Okay, one was the gift of healing through the Spirit, another was dairy farming, and the third was the pioneers. And the way that sentence all runs on together is just like how Nathan responds when he's talking about things. Frank couldn't always tell which one he was on because he talked slow and he meandered like a flatland riverbed. He paused frequently to talk about people's ancestors and about their kids who'd gone off to college and lost their testimonies, or about the list of people who had owned a particular piece of land, or about the fact that if a plowshare was shaped in a certain way, it poisoned the soil. If Frank tried to steer him back to his topic so he'd get through and shut up sooner, he would glare at him with disgust and say, "What's your hurry? If I'm going to tell this story, I just as well tell all of it." Now, this is the story that Nathan's going to tell, and this is was a real eye-opener for me this time I read it. "Now you take dam building," Nathan said. "You'd imagine it'd be easy to build a dam on the Escalante River, wouldn't you? Well, then how come the Escalante pioneers had three dams wash out before they finally got one to stick? Which, by the way, you probably didn't have any idea of, did you? That dam west of town is the fourth one the pioneers built, and it's been there since 1887. And that dam will be there when the Savior returns, and I'll tell you why. One day about noon, when the men from town were standing around at that old dam site, this stranger came riding up on a crop-eared jack mule, and the men thought he was one of them mining engineers from down on the Colorado. He sat a minute looking things over, and then he says, "It won't ever do, but I'll tell you what we'll do." And he took them upriver, about a quarter mile, to where the stream cuts through rock, and he told them to blast out two keys on either side of the river to make a little low dam of solid concrete and rock anchored into them two keyholes. The whole idea being the big floods would just run over the dam and never tear it out. Now, you're wondering, of all the pieces I could have quoted from this novel, why did I pick that one? Because when I was given the eulogy for my grandmother a month ago, this was a story that I told because I had heard it from her, I thought, I had heard it from her brother, one of the folklore stories that went around Overton, Nevada. And I read this and I thought, I never heard that from her brother. I have absorbed this from the backslider. And I thought, here I had heard it from my grandmother. And I thought about it a minute again, and I said, I have spoken in a Ward steakhouse in front of all these people and told this story about my grandmother, and it's not about her at all. It is from some heretic Mormon novel. And I thought about it a minute, and I said, no, I am sure this was a story that was told about Overton, Nevada, and it was about the water coming down the wash, and they had to rebuild the levee or the dike or whatever it was to keep the water coming down, because Overton was named because they had to pick the town up and move it over because it kept getting washed out. And besides, when I heard the story, it was about a man that comes up on a white Jenny. It's not a crop-eared mule. It's like, oh, I feel better now. I genuinely heard that story. Turn the page over, and Frank says, just to be mean, "I always heard it wasn't a crop-eared Jack mule, it was a white Jenny." So I still don't know where I got this story from. Actually, I think it has been going around. I think I heard it both places. But the point is that this speaks like true dialogue? Because this is exactly what I would have heard from my grandma, who was just about a generation older from Frank. In the eulogy, I talked a lot about my grandmother's life growing up on the frontier, and it reminded me when I read this again that Frank, at Salsifer's funeral, is really down in the dumps, and he says, "Everybody dies poor," which is a really pessimistic thing to say. And I understand why Frank says this at this point, because he is so pessimistic and gloomy, and materially this is true. In his self-hatred, Frank denies that the opposite is also true within Mormonism, that everybody dies rich because they have a promise of a kind of heaven that nobody else can have. At 19, when I read this book, as I told you, I was appalled by Frank's perversions. Now that I'm 38, honestly, I envy Frank, his eternal youth, not just that, but his energy, his passions. I wish I had as much passion as he does for anything. He seems to go all day working and still have time to have uncensored dreams at night. When I was 19, I thought Frank's perversions were physical and sexual. And he seemed to be wallowing in sin. I was pretty willing to buy into Frank's own assessment of himself. As I'm older now, I think Frank's real perversions are his view of God, which Marianne recognizes as well. And as I mentioned when I started talking, as I reread the novel, the comic parts come through more clearly, but the dark parts come through more clearly too. When the first time I read it, I didn't really have a deep sense of what Frank was up to as he gets towards the end of the novel. It gets more horrifying when I reread it, even though I know it's going to have a happy ending, because I feel more strongly what Frank really has in him to do, that he really can do something really awful. He is really that low. Another person that I passed this novel on to a year ago was Harold Bloom, who's our neighbor. He's a well-known literary critic at Yale. He writes a zillion things. He comes out with a new book of literary criticism every year. He's our neighbor, and we see him every now and then. And his birthday's in the summer, so I got a copy of the novel, and I passed it on to him for his birthday present. And I said, "I think you'll like it. It's about God, and it's about sex," which are two of Harold Bloom's favorite topics, at least to talk about. I think he writes about them, too. I don't know if he read it. He never got back to me. I'm going to go pin him down and ask him and urge him to read it again if he hasn't read it. But a comparison that comes to mind, this will make Levi uncomfortable, I think, but bear with me, and I'll tell you why I'm talking about this. A comparison that comes to mind for the great cowboy novel is great cowboy novelist is Cormac McCarthy, who's just come out with a new novel. It's just come out with a new novel this summer, and I haven't read it. But when you talk about the great literature of the Southwest, Cormac McCarthy would be the one who wins that crown for public acceptance. And he is a favorite of Harold Bloom, too. And Cormac McCarthy's view of humanity and of the Southwest, it takes place in the same kind of landscape, but it is a pessimistic. Pessimistic is too weak a word for this. It is a bloody view of human nature. And dispiriting and exhausting in my reading. I'm not going to read the new novel because I found it does not draw me back in. The bloody damned human nature is hinted at in The Backslider. And it's hinted at in the same landscape. It's in the wilderness that of things that can happen. But it's there, and he pulls away from that. You know this. This is the novel where Frank is redeemed at the end, not an easy redemption. And if it were an easy redemption, it wouldn't be the same. It wouldn't matter as much. And that's why one of my favorite lines that I found rereading it was this, that Marianne says to him when they are beginning to get close. She says, "I pray for you every day, Frank. Sweet Jesus, please don't be like Frank thinks you are." And I mean, what kind of a prayer is that? To say, "Thank God, dear God, please don't be like Frank thinks you are." So although in the wider world of literary criticism, people may be drawn to Cormac McCarthy, I will stand up and defend The Backslider and say, what is great literature? Great literature bears rereading. It's hard. It wrenches your soul, and this book does that to me. At a previous year in Sunstone, I was having lunch with some people, among whom was Wayne Booth, a literary critic at Chicago. And I was talking with him about literature, and I got all teary describing something, and he said, "If it moves you that much, then it is worth paying attention to." So I will take his assessment of that to back me up and say, for me, this is great literature, and I will pass it on to my friends and say, you read it, and if it doesn't affect you that way, then you're missing out on something. And I want to take a minute to get over my sniffles, but to say that this is our opportunity to gather together the reader responses and the community of readers that this book has created, and to do something to mark that, and for this anniversary that's coming up, for this 20 years of the book, which I've now spent all my adult life with, and it's been profoundly affecting. Well then, all right, so enough of my testimony of reading. I'd like to move to the part of this discussion where we get your input, and I'm going to move away from the microphone. So if this is being recorded, you're not going to hear anything more. I'm going to move over to the whiteboard. Now I hope you all can hear me. It is 12:37, which means we have about 15 minutes, right? We're supposed to go to 12:45. Well, we'll go 3 minutes over because it's worth it. At least that much. I have three questions. I have three questions that I wanted to solicit your input on. I have asked Dan if he will support me in doing a Festschrift project for The Backslider, and he enthusiastically said yes. I am organizing it and editing it or collecting it and collecting, first of all, input. Questions that I want to ask your opinion on is, one, what should we do? Two, how should we do it? Three, who should do it? Who we think of to contribute? This is a very simple thing. Just to begin planning for this. Now, the question, what should we do? I had in mind, the way I thought of it, was this. We could do, I can think of three kinds of essays or things we could collect. One is personal responses to the book, and I definitely want to go forward with that. Another is criticism.
literary criticism, and the third is comparative essays. It's like this, it's not like this. What are your thoughts? What would you like to see written, or what would you be interested in reading about the backslider?
Well, what I'd like to see is it published by mainstream press, that my signature to move it on to a wider readership, because I think it would be, I think it does have a lot of potential to be of interest to a general readership.
I agree with you. Let me think. Levi, what are the copyright issues on this? Can signature let it go? If we found, suppose somebody did say, yeah.
You do a signature, how would that deal with it?
Really? It's not you.
That's right.
Okay.
Does signature have any plans to re-release it in an artback form?
I heard that they're working on the 25th anniversary. So we'll do this for next year, and then it will help springboard their project for the 25th anniversary. I think, from what I hear, they are planning to republish it, which I think they ought to do, because it's hard to get copies now, except for the very small format paperback. Yeah.
Let's put a movie back up there. If each of us donate, let's say, $5,000, I'll raise my hand. We're getting up to maybe 4 minutes.
As you know, Bruce read the first page. He said, there's our first 30 seconds right there. Morning breaks us as a prayer. Actually, Eric, these four students who got to, I'll get you a second, made a pact to make this into a movie.
Yeah.
Are they serious?
Oh, they're serious as death.
Really?
Yeah.
I mean, there was that weird movie that came out of BYU, like, oh, what was it? Napoleon Dynamite? I haven't seen it, but it is possible. BYU students do get together and make a movie.
Jared's not one of the group. If Jared were, it would get made, because Jared right now can make anything he wants.
Why can't we get this Jared guy into... Do you know him? Is he one of your students?
I know Jared.
Well, let's put them together.
Jared knows the novel. What?
He knows the novel.
He's got other projects. I think it's on his back burner. The whole...
Well, so at least invite Jared to the activity.
Yeah.
And the other, you know, just a handful. It seems like there's a handful of other possible Mormon directors that at least ought to come, and we could prod them with the idea.
I mean, that'd be my hesitation right now, is that I don't think Jared stylistically is the right director for this project.
That's true. We just wanted him to come on.
I think he's a brilliant director, I think it's a brilliant film, Napoleon Dynamite. I don't think it's quite the right approach, right? The right style. There are other directors who I'd rather have take it on.
You know, this reminds me, I should at least send them a letter about the Feshridge project and see if any of them are interested in Backslider or interested in writing a short thing.
The guy who contacts Sterling Van Wagner. And Sterling is going to be directing the next couple of movies in the series of unfortunate events. Not that the Gerald Lund novels, the Working Glory series. But Sterling's that may not necessarily be a recommendation. But Sterling, for years, has wanted to make a novel out of Giant Joshua.
Yeah.
A film out of Giant Joshua. Yeah, and so he's got the rights and he's got a script, and what he's hoping is that the work of the Glory movies will be good enough and make him enough money that he'll be able to do the next.
Okay.
To do that next.
So I take from your suggestion that as a coordinator of this project, I should get on my list.
Sterling Van Wagner, definitely.
Everyone that Eric can refer me to, and I will send them a message saying we're working on this. Are you interested? Now I'm going to come over here and then we'll introduce you.
This might be a small step. Get it to a wider exposure, and I'm not so sure it would work as an audio book, but I think Levi ought to record it.
It only takes about 25 hours.
It's super cheap.
I think that's a great idea.
It's super cheap and easy to do.
It lends itself perfectly.
Yeah. And Levi would be good reading it, but this guy can really do it.
You would be really good. Yeah. 25 hours.
That's a crude estimate. It might be longer.
Now, this is an interesting idea. And I said, do we look for a general distributor of audiobooks, or do we ask Sunstone to sponsor it? Actually, doing audio is not so expensive. You do one version, you put it on CD, and you just run them out like waffles, right? This is a great idea. Yeah.
Well, I think I have two suggestions. One pretty well defined, the other maybe kind of a little more nebulous. As a professional reader who's always been a common reader, I think whatever you do ought to have stuff in it by people who are not professional readers with academic credentials. I can try to do both kinds of things myself, but everybody knows that I've read Ulysses, that I've read Chaucer and Shakespeare.
Yeah.
Thought about the theory of comedy and all that, and I'm really interested in how just my friends and neighbors feel about books. I want their voices. Second suggestion is, this is the more obvious one because I don't do this sort of thing. What about online discussion of Backslider? Is there a way to invite widely through AML list, through Sunstone? It would have to be winnowed. It would have to be edited. The other thing is actually taping live conversations of people.
Like an oral history.
Book groups. You know, get your book group to read it and then take what they say about it. See, could you really don't like the insularity of professional literary criticism very much, except when it's brilliantly well done.
Yeah.
You know. So, but that's mainly for me as a professional novel.
Sheree, it'd be really interesting to have you interview Levi and then have that made available as a podcast or something you can download from the site.
Interview. Actually, Levi?
Are you up for that?
Well, yeah, sure.
Let me
say a little bit here. I'm very honored that all of you
come up.
Are.
You think you can come up?
No, he doesn't have to. Well, somebody's going to miss that. I really appreciate it.
Actually, the tape is going to stop here in about 1 minute.
Oh, because it's
I'll talk to you later, son. I'll give you my views on your project.
I'm very honored to... by what you've said, and I've sat back there laughing and enjoying the book shamelessly. Let me just say that Sheree, that I think you all approached this project, the Festschrift idea, very realistically, and possibly be ready to abandon it. And I would, just from having sat in on this kind of venture with other books, I would say that the first thing would be to see if you can line up a publisher that thinks it's a viable project, which it may not be. And it might be worth a good article rather than a whole book or something of that sort. But then it would seem to me that from there on, if there's a publisher that sounds interested in it, but then you see what you can develop with other people.
I don't mean to put you on the spot, Levi, as current editor of Dialogue. What about an issue of Dialogue devoted?
Yeah, what about an issue of Dialogue devoted? No, right, I would have to recruise myself. At any rate, I'm very honored by the proceedings of this meeting. Thank you.
Well, Levi, let me tell you, I have thought of this. And as I mentioned earlier, I have two babies and I have a job and blah, blah, blah. So I also, in my job, do project planning, and we plan it down to the minute how much time and effort things are going to take. Now, of course, that's not always possible. But my answer to this is I have thought of this, and let me clarify for people who are here. I have thought of a strategy, which is kind of an escalating involvement strategy. The first person I approached, actually I shot the idea around with a couple of smaller email lists that I was on, so people, are you thinking this would be good? Are you excited about this? I got enough response back that people are excited. And I talked to Dan at Sunstone. Now the original idea is that Dan will be the first point publisher for this. So all we have to get are a number of good essays and we can publish them in Sunstone. We can collect 20 essays, publish the best 5, the rest up on the web. So you see, this is a pretty small commitment to get a number of reader responses. Dan is committed to doing that already. And as book review editor, I can demand space and say this is a form of book review. Next up from that might be to go over Levi's head to the board of dialogue and say, can we do an honorary issue dialogue? I understand there's a conflict of interest, and he certainly won't want to be seen as self-promoting using the journal for that purpose, but we could make it abundantly clear this is not his idea, and he just happens to be editor at the time, but this was an initiative that was independent and taken.
The board's being awfully decent and careful to stay out of my editorial decisions.
Well, now, what I'm saying is there might be a way to get around your current editorship as an impediment. That's just a thing.
Well, I'm going to get out of
it. This is a historical coincidence that you happen to be editor at the time that this anniversary comes up. And the third level of publishing would be to actually publish a self-standing volume. And I am not going to commit to that or think about that until I begin to put together, say, an executive committee to help organize the project and begin to see what kind of things might go into this volume. The interesting thing is, because of the web, we can now publish things very cheaply. So we can have this sort of great gradation of collecting things before we have to think and worry about money and what it would cost to publish a book and would it sell, et cetera, et cetera.
Well, just the last thing I want to say is, I think it's a great idea. I may just participate